There's not quite sufficient time to do real justice to the body of teaching on equanimity, but I want to give you something of a snapshot view. There's a story about Ajahn Chah, one of the great forest masters, and he was out for a walk with some of his monks and nuns, and they passed by on the path a great big boulder sitting by the side of the path. And Ajahn Chah turned to his nuns and monks and said, "Do you think that boulder is very heavy?" And they said, "Well, look at the size of it. Of course it's very heavy." Ajahn Chah responded, "Only if you pick it up." I think it's quite a pithy teaching. How often we can go through life dragging the boulders that we've picked up, and sometimes we can leave them be as they are and where they are. Now, equanimity really has these two dimensions. On its deepest dimension, equanimity is really the cooling of the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. Equanimity is the embodied understanding of the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta. This is the embodied understanding of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and non-self. This is how equanimity is act. This is the character of equanimity. We've stepped out of the argument. We've stepped out of the argument that gets manifested in aversion and craving and resistance and denial and manipulation and agitation. So it's the embodied understanding of the three characteristics. So this is equanimity on its deepest level. As a path and as a practice, it's often referred to as the willingness and the capacity to be equally near all things. To be equally near all things, the pleasant, the unpleasant, the lovely, the unlovely, the challenging, the supportive, to find a way of being within this world of conditions where we are not governed by them, not defined by them, but also recognizing that we are not invulnerable to the world of conditions. You know, the world of conditions with all its changes and its losses and its loveliness and its unloveliness touch us deeply. So we're not moving towards a place of being beige. You know, we're not moving towards a place of unresponsiveness or uncaring or not feeling. One can be equanimous, deeply equanimous, and yet still feel deep grief and deep joy. What we have in the midst of those is that we are not arguing that it shouldn't be happening or that I need to keep this or I need to get rid of this. So please don't think of equanimity as being some sort of emotional homogenization. It is not that. It's recognizing the vulnerability to the world of conditions that we live within, all of the changes, all of the uncertainties, and yet finding a way of being where we are not defined by them. This is a practice and a cultivation. So this capacity to be equally near all things, the Buddha often speaks of equanimity in several different dimensions. The first of these dimensions is what he calls the changing seasons of our lives, you know, the changing events of our lives, pain and pleasure, loss and gain, praise and blame, success, failure. These touch all of our lives, these extremes. No one is, you know, always gaining, always pleasant, always successful. You know, these touch all of our lives. And yet we see how easily we are knocked off balance. The gravitation towards the pleasant, the gravitation towards success, the gravitation towards gain and praise, and the denial and the resistance to their opposites. And what the Buddha taught is, these are the weather patterns of every human life. And the tendency to define ourselves by them is optional. This is where the selfing comes in. I have a good meditation, I'm a terrific meditator. I have what I call a bad meditation, I'm a failure. That pleasure says something about my worthiness and pain says something about my failure as a human being. That success brings a sense of approval and failure tells us about our unworthiness. It's about how to stand in the middle of this, knowing them, feeling them, not denying that these have emotional connotations, but not being governed by them. And this is the teaching of being equally near all things. It's a tremendous freedom in that, and that is what is presented in the Satipatthana, of abiding independent in this world, not governed by anything. So, obviously, to be able to stand in the middle of all of those extremes and those changes really means, to a very large extent, that we have learned to step out of the governance of craving and aversion. Because it is not the events of the world that knock us off balance so much as our reactions to them. In terms of, contemporary mindfulness teaching, this is the key. It's recognized that one of the triggers for depressive relapse is unexpected loss. To really embody our understanding of change, there are no unexpected losses. That's quite big. It has quite big implications for how we live our lives, for how actually we relate to the people and the things in our lives, our identities, our roles. It has quite big implications about, not picking up the rock. It doesn't have to be heavy. Not being governed by them has quite big implications about the embodied understanding of non-self. That we just don't take it all so personally. It's not about us having made mistakes or not being good enough or not having tried hard enough. This is life. This is a life of conditions that we cannot control, that are unpredictable, that are uncertain. So there's something about being able to stand in the middle of all things that, we know deeply in our bones about the unreliability and unpredictability of a world of conditions. We know deeply that we cannot rely upon the world of conditions for that enduring happiness. We know deeply that it is not all about me. So there's a congruence that comes about where we're living in alignment with those understandings rather than dissonant, rather than separate or arguing with them. So this is the first kind of domain of equanimity, is in relationship to this world of changing events and conditions and all that it brings with us, and about changing the lens through which we see that world of conditions. And actually really beginning to see through the lens of the three characteristics, not as good ideas, or sometimes good ideas, but as actualities in living. The second domain of equanimity that is less spoken about in the early texts, but I think this is because it really was, the teachings were often delivered to monastic communities, who'd kind of left behind a, world of engaged relationships and all of that. But I think it's a really crucial piece of the teaching of equanimity for those of us who live in a world, interfacing, interacting with people that we care about deeply, interacting and interfacing with people that we struggle with. You know, but this is our life. It is a relational life. We are relational beings, you know, and that means that we are touched deeply by those relationships. And this is probably, in my mind, the most challenging place to cultivate equanimity. Because this is, you know, you witness your parents age and become frail, you know, you witness your children struggle, you know, you witness you're part of losing people you care about deeply. You know, there are people you wish to be away from. It is really the domain of equanimity, I think, where, you know, this practice really in a way matters the most. Because there's nothing more designed to knock us off balance than other people. It seems. Although, if we look a little bit more closely, there's nothing more designed to knock us off balance than our reactions to other people, both the lovely and the unlovely. There's a... I'm going to repeat a story from my book, so those of you who've read it, you don't need to. But I had a student, and I think this is not uncommon, whose son was a heroin addict, and you know, he did everything that he could to protect the son that he loved so much, you know, and yet no matter what he did, it didn't make any difference. And he told me about going to an art gallery and actually seeing a picture of a woman standing by the side of a river watching her baby being swept away down the river, and in this painting the woman had no arms. And he said, rather than depressing him, he said it was such a startling revelation to him that actually really, really altered how he was relating to this difficult son. And he said he really realized that as much as he loved his child, he did not have the power to change the course of his son's mind. That's a big one, isn't it? It's a really big one. It doesn't mean that we become inert or passive or give up or become resigned. It doesn't mean that we stop acting as if we could change the course of their mind in a way. But we stop demanding, and we stop investing in that outcome, you know, and we really accept the limits of our power to control the world of conditions, including the conditions of another person's mind and their choices and how they're living. That's a huge renunciation. That's a huge renunciation. But it is also so true for us, isn't it? Has anybody ever really been successful in changing the course of your mind, you know, without your cooperation and consent and engagement? Probably not. Probably not. In a very real way, we know that is actually in our hands. Doesn't mean that we're not supported or loved or encouraged, but actually to make those changes is really in our hands. And I think this is probably the real heart of the teaching of relational equanimity. And relational equanimity is a huge piece of this pathway. It's bound to be for us. But it also allows room for, I think, a greater sense of compassion. You know, as we recognize, you know, just as we can feel so stuck in our own kind of repetitive stories and circles and, you know, IKEA moments, so are others. And actually, I think in times, you know, especially, you know, when we live in a time where there is such a temptation to get into the self and other mode, you know, the people we care for and the people that we really object to and make into an enemy and make into an opponent. You know, one of the deepest ways of equanimity really relates to compassion is actually compassion for ignorance rather than blame. And, you know, that's really quite a big step. to find compassion for ignorance. It's not about compassion for a person. It's compassion, you know, it's a very big leap to say you should suddenly feel compassion for your worst enemy. But it's compassion for ignorance. And equanimity allows for that, because without allowing for that, we're just left with a world of blame and judgment and shame and ill will. So this relational equanimity is not something we have. I think it's something we practice, you know. And, you know, when we see ourselves being with those that we care for deeply, to see where our minds are going into that next step of thinking, you know, I can somehow, you know, really protect their safety and their well-being and their health and their thriving. To know that we can't do that, you know, as a parent or as a partner or as a child, we know that we can't actually do that. And that doesn't mean that we fall into indifference or anything like that. It doesn't mean that we stop acting. But it does mean that deep willingness to meet life as it is. And to meet the limits of our control as it is. You know, when we see ourselves faced with someone that we really, really struggle with, you know, to really have a sense of, you know, where we move into the shame and the blame and the judgment and what it is to be equally near that discomfort. How near, you determine, you know? You don't stand so near to the difficult that you get burned. You know, sometimes you might stand at quite a distance, you know? But you're still not abandoning. You're still not abandoning. You stand at enough distance to actually be safe, but you're still not abandoning. You know, I think this is going to be part of all of our lives. Many of you are in the middle of it right now. You know, probably most people in this room are in the middle of this right now, you know, and it's a really hard one. It's a really hard one, but this is where equanimity rescues us from terror and panic and anxiety and agitation, is to recognize that we do everything that we can and there are limits to what we are able to do, even with the participation of another. These are really hard life lessons to learn. They're hard life lessons to learn, but they have so much rooted in our understanding of anicca, dukkha, anatta. This is an embodied, this is where equanimity is an embodied understanding. It's where it's really an embodied understanding. Question? So equally near are things, and they're also saying sometimes you need to stand at a distance where you're not getting burned. Yes, standing equally near all things is the aspiration of equanimity, but it's a process there. You know, I think particularly with, you know, in human relationship, particularly with the most difficult in our lives, you know, it would just be foolhardy to say, you know, I'm going to place myself by your side, you know, when they may not have your well-being at heart. Okay, so standing equally near all things is standing equally near all things in your mind, not necessarily physically. But that means that we're actually really releasing some of the anxiety and the fear and the selfing that makes us want to flee and makes us want to create an other. And that's why I think this is a tough path, you know. This is a tough challenge, but you have to remember that every moment of flight is also a moment of flight from ourselves. We don't abandon the other without abandoning some part of ourselves. So an embodied understanding. It's almost like there's layers in equanimity. But you know, a lot of the layers. We see similar themes going through all of the layers, and the themes that we see going through the layers that really destroy equanimity are essentially craving and aversion. You know, and craving and aversion, you know, have many children. You know, including papancha, including you know, flight. Movement towards responses in terms of self and othering. So, you know, in many ways, you know, when the Buddha, you know, says, you know, oh, craving is the origin of dukkha, it sounds incredibly simplistic, you know, because we can think of lots of other origins of dukkha other than craving. But actually, it's hard to see that much dukkha, that where craving is not implicated, and of course, its counterpart of aversion. So in many ways, when we speak about equanimity, cooling the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, those are big words. You know, they're very big words, you know, and we don't think of ourselves as a greedy person or as a hating person, you know, or a deluded person. But we probably see, you know, quite more moments than we would like in a single day of craving and aversion. And this is where we begin to really cool those fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. And in a way, you know, that does not leave a vacuum. You know, you cool the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, and what's left? What remains? What is present? What is allowed to flourish?
Joy,
compassion, kindness, empathy, generosity, you know, all of the wholesome qualities that are actually so stunted by the power of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, and that when the Buddha speaks about nibbana, you know, he doesn't speak about nibbana as a state. He speaks about nibbana as an understanding. And I think it's really important to absorb that. It's an embodied understanding of what it means to be free, not to be not bound by greed, hatred, and delusion. This is why we need to more naturalize this word nibbana. You know, because, you know, when we just think of this state or this epiphany or this singular moment of enlightenment, you know, then it feels unreachable for us. But I think you need to undertake the practice of nibbana-ing. You know, which is actually liberating the moment from greed, hatred, and delusion. Any questions? That's actually all I have to say. Yeah. I mean, there's probably a lot more that could be said, but I think that's a good... Any reflections, questions?
In equanimity, you talked about having compassion for ignorance. And if you were the person having compassion for ignorance, isn't there a certain arrogance in that?
Well, I would hope you're not the person having compassion for ignorance, that there is simply compassion for ignorance.
Right.
You know, you could be the person who says, oh, I'm so compassionate about your ignorance, which is indeed very arrogant. Because it's actually kind of an embodiment of my ignorance, you know, is that I can have compassion for your ignorance. Compassion is much more the recognition that ignorance is not somebody's fault.
But even the definition of ignorance, but people will see it quite differently. Like we're looking at equanimity.
Okay, if I give you the classical definition of avidya, ignorance. Well, first of all, it's not knowing how things actually are.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the simplest definition. The more classical definition is held within the distortions, the way not seeing things how they actually are creates a certain distorted way of a distorted perception, where we see the unacceptable as being acceptable, where we see the unbeautiful as being beautiful, where we see permanence where there is only change, and when we see self where there is no independent self-existence. So those are the distortions. Now, many of those distortions generate a great deal of confusion and struggle and suffering. Okay, so the compassion is more that we take the blame out of ignorance. That we take the blame out of ignorance. You know, because in Buddhist psychology, ignorance is not a lack of knowledge. You can have a great deal of knowledge and a great deal of ignorance. So it's not an absence of knowledge, but ignorance is not somebody's fault. You know, we don't get up in the morning and decide a really good day to be ignorant. You know, no one does that. You know, ignorance is what we're trying to wake up from, these distortions. But the compassion is for how much suffering is actually born of those distortions. You know, not just in the person, but in how the person manifests in life.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So is there a similarity between ignorance and wrong view?
Well, there are some similarities, I mean, in terms of the distortions, because wise view is generally framed with understanding the three characteristics, you know, and understanding dukkha and the origins of dukkha. Whereas when you get into avidya or ignorance, they start talking about a number of different distortions, such as seeing the unbeautiful to be beautiful, seeing the unacceptable to be unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. But it's all mixed up in wrong view. No. This is called equality conceit. This word mana I use to describe the self story is actually relational positioning. So there's two forms of selfing in Buddhist psychology. One is personality view. You know, I am, you know, beautiful, unlovely, you know, successful, failure, popular, blah, blah. One is personality view. It's fleeting, it's changing. The other manifestation of self in Buddhist psychology is this much more hidden level, which is called mana. Now, this is relational positioning of self. So I'm either better than you, I'm superior to you, or I'm worse than you, I'm inferior to you, or we're all the same. We're all the same. And this is actually equality conceit. It's an interesting one because it sometimes looks like acceptance, but often it's not acceptance. It's often an acceptance of mediocrity. All human beings are confused, you know. Oh, human beings, you know, nobody can actually be enlightened when, you know, we're all lost in the same mire of delusion, you know. It's kind of reassuring. You know, it's kind of reassuring. Oh, great, you know, I'm not alone in this delusion, yeah. But in Buddhist psychology, this is one of the most, this is probably the really subtle shadow side of genuine acceptance, is actually this reductionism of human beings to all being the same. Because, you know, and the danger of it in terms of the Buddhist teaching is that the surrender of aspiration, the surrender of possibility, this acceptance of limitation. So the Buddha really cautioned against equality conceit. You know, actually, I mean, there can be part of compassion when we actually all see the fallibility of human beings. You know, that's wonderful. you know, to see the fallibility of human beings and to be able to learn to bring a more genuine acceptance. But acceptance is never, it's like mindfulness is never a destination in itself in Buddhist teaching. Acceptance is never the destination in itself in Buddhist teaching. It's the place where we're starting to put down the argument so there can begin a process of transformation. So we need to be a little bit careful of that shadow side, you know, where we can actually give up our efforts to actually change or transform, because we're all like this. That was just a sideshow. That was just a digression. Just be a little bit careful of it. A little bit careful of that shadow side, you know, because I see these two extremes in mind, you know. One is the actual striving for perfection, which we know the dangers of that, you know. And the other extreme of that often goes under this umbrella word of, you know, being accepting of all things. Well, there's a lot in this world which is not acceptable. You know, I can accept that it's unacceptable, but you know, I'm not going to bow to the unacceptable. You know, so that's almost the other extreme. And in the middle of those two, I think there is a middle path where, you know, yes, we recognize fallibility, we recognize that perfection is a romantic notion, but we also recognize that, you know, there's a genuine sense of possibility for human beings, you know, and that involves actually really understanding and transforming what is unacceptable. And I think in terms of the Buddhist teaching, anything that creates and recreates dukkha is unacceptable, you know, and that includes our own confusions and our own cravings and our own aversions. So, you know, it's kind of acknowledging that it's there, but being careful of that shadow side that almost kind of endorses its okayness.
I'm just trying to think of a way of getting out of having aversion.
Yeah. to kind of say that we're all aversive is probably not the way. The way you get out of aversion is, you know, traditionally it is through metta and through compassion. It's through the cultivation of metta and compassion and really nurturing and nourishing that and really fasting the aversion cycles that are supported by papancha. It's not that aversion doesn't arise, but then how do we meet it? You know, how do we actually meet it? Do we run with it? Or do we recognize, no, this is something that is really fueling the fires of dukkha. And actually, at this moment, it might be better, you know, many of the ways we've talked about this weekend, it might be good to explore it somatically, it might be good to take our attention elsewhere, but it might be really useful in those moments to explore the options of metta and compassion. Yeah. Many people will say that compassion is far more effective in the face of aversion than metta.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion doesn't actually make hierarchies. Compassion is about compassion for suffering. It's not about self or other. It's about compassion for suffering wherever it arises. You know, and it's really recognizing also those two aspects of compassion, you know, the anukampa karuna, you know, the heart that can tremble in the face of compassion, but then that which is the anukampa part, but the karuna part is actually our response to suffering. So compassion is never ever presented as just a trembling of the heart. It's actually what we do about it. It's actually what we do about it, you know, and one really needs to draw on some of the, you know, the historical imagery around compassion, where, you know, yes, we've got the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin that is so receptive and you know, empathic, and then we've got the armed warriors, you know, with their shields and their crossbows and all the rest of it, you know, that kind of fearlessness of compassion that may very much be what is embodied. Yes, please.
I don't get the last part of the word.
Well, in Buddhist terminology, look at the two parts of compassion. I mean, I think we're, you know, it's very important to recognize.
Literal soldiers.
Yeah. Well, they're presented as armed warriors. I mean, this is just imagery. You know, it's just imagery. And what it's meant to represent is that compassion is committed to bringing about the end of the origins of dukkha. It's not just responding to the presence of dukkha, but committed to really uprooting the origins of dukkha.
It's just that I'm just trying to sort it out from, you know, I grew up Catholic, and they said one of your duties as a Catholic is if you're called, you go to war for your country.
No, it's not armies. We're not talking about armies here. We're not talking about armies of compassion. No, we're talking much more about the fearlessness part and the commitment to uprooting the causes of dukkha. Yeah. Yeah, we could use a little of Manjushri's sword sometimes in terms of Papancha. Let's just cut it off. Okay, any remaining unclarities, or are we all totally now?
Anything that you've covered in the last 2 days in any of your books?
Well, yeah, in different books. I mean, obviously, Boundless Heart has much to do with the Brahma Viharas, but I have a new book coming out in May, which is actually to do with the psychology of mindfulness. I've co-written it with a professor of psychology. Well, you know, we're still struggling with the publisher about the title. We don't like their title, and they don't like our title, and we actually have. But it's going to be something like mindfulness, ancient wisdom, and contemporary in modern psychology. It's going to be something like that.
Is that yours?
Huh?
Is that your title?
We're holding out. But it's going to be published by Guildford. Yeah. Well, it's an academic press. Yeah.
Is it going to be readable by a lady?
Yes. Yes. We don't even use hardly any Pali in it. It's yes. It's meant to be for lay people as much as it's meant to be for clinicians and teachers of mindfulness. No, it's very, no, it's readable. I have confidence.
Thank you.
It's just not a chatty book.
I get that.
It uses case histories rather than stories.
No IKEA stories.
No IKEA stories. It uses case histories rather than stories.
Okay.
But that's also good because case histories are people's stories. Case histories are people's stories. Yeah. Let's take 5 minutes to sit. My break. few thanks before we go. I really want to thank everyone, all the volunteers over the weekend. You know, it's really so important that people step forward to make these events happen, and I'm aware of how much goes on behind the scenes. So thank you, everyone who participated in that. I was very touched yesterday when Brock was talking about Dana, because I hadn't realized until this weekend the way in which the Dana thread runs through everything that Victoria Insight does. It's one of the few places I know that doesn't actually have even a set fee to cover their costs for these events. You know, so that's really a big commitment of trust and confidence, you know. So just really appreciating how this is an organization that really survives on Dana and your participation in that, you know, just as the teachers have done for generations since the time of the Buddha. I find that quite moving, actually, you know, because most organizations will at least set a fee to cover their costs. It's quite moving. So I want to thank all of you for your attention. It's kind of, these weekends are a bit hard going, I think. You probably go home so hearing me in your sleep, you know, his voice coming in, you know. But I know it's quite demanding, actually, to sustain attention over so many hours of teaching. I really thank you for your attention and your questions and your presence. And I wish you well and that you land softly. Thank you.